Welcome to Dialogue on WUOT. I'm Claire Heddles. Today's episode, How Climate Change Impacts East Tennessee. During a recent WUOT listener feedback survey, we asked you, our listeners, what topics are most important to you? What keeps you up at night? And over again, we heard that climate change is top of mind. And for me, climate change can feel a little disconnected from my day-to-day life. It's something that gives me general concern about the future, and I wonder about it when giving morning forecasts, but it usually doesn't feel tangible. So I have some amazing experts on the show today to unpack how climate change impacts this part of the world and what's being done about it here in Tennessee. So first we have Dr. Kelsey Ellis. She's a University of Tennessee professor and physical geographer specializing in meteorology and climatology. Her research focuses mainly on extreme and hazardous weather, including hurricanes, tornadoes, and extreme temperatures and precipitation. She also studies how humans both impact and are impacted by local climates. So, Kelsey, welcome to Dialogue.
Thanks for having me.
Also on the panel is Isabella Killias, the local coordinator for Sunrise Movement in Knoxville. Sunrise Movement is a youth-led advocacy organization focused on combating climate change. Locally, the Sunrise Movement advises Knoxville Mayor's Climate Council and organizes campaigns for environmental justice. So, Isabella, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Claire. Thank you so much.
And we also have Dr. Sing-Lee Grum, a professor at the University of Tennessee who specializes in conservation ecology and how global environmental change impacts ecosystems, biodiversity, and land use. He's recently been exploring how climate change affects aquatic species in southern Appalachia. So, Sing-Lee, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Claire. Thanks for having me.
And if you're listening in and would like to be a part of the discussion, you can email us your questions at wuotnews@utk.edu or comment on our latest Dialogue post on Facebook or Twitter at WUOTFM. And if you stay tuned, later in the show, we'll take some calls from listeners. But in the meantime, let's kick off the show. So, Kelsey, I'll start with you first and ask about the most recent extreme weather we've seen in Tennessee. From the tornadoes in Middle Tennessee last month to flooding across the state in the last couple of weeks, how much of a role does climate change play in some of the extreme weather events we've seen in Tennessee lately?
Well, it is impossible to attribute one specific weather event or even a year or two of extreme weather to climate change. And instead, we need to look at longer periods. Climatologists specifically like to look at 30 years or more because that's long enough where we can find long-term trends and also weed out like natural cycles like El Nino and some lesser known cycles that affect our climate. So looking at those two hazards that we've seen a decent bit of lately, both tornadoes and floods, both of those are being impacted by climate change based on trends we've seen over the last 30 to 50 years or more. With flooding, that is due to the change in the precipitation regime across much of the Southeast and other areas. And what we're seeing is what we refer to as flashier precipitation. So it's kind of like an all or nothing. Like you get a lot of rain one day or one week and then you get nothing. So you can see more flooding and more droughts at the same time, which can be really confusing. And the tornado story is really getting interesting. There's a lot of research that's come out recently showing that there are two major findings. More tornadoes are happening on fewer days. So say we still get the same number of tornadoes per year, they'll be clustered on fewer days. So once again, it's kind of one of those all or nothing. Are you going to get no tornadoes? Or are you going to get an outbreak? And then the other big conclusion on tornadoes, which has to do with Tennessee, is that they are shifting toward the Southeast. So if people in the Southeast are saying, hey, it looks like we're getting hit more than before, well, it's true. We are getting relatively more tornadoes in the Southeast than there were a few decades ago, and we're seeing them shift from the Great Plains into our region.
And as we talk about some of these long-term trends, Sing-Lee, how does climate change impact ecosystems here in Tennessee?
So indeed, climate change is affecting Tennessee and the Southeast in general. Over the last 30 years, from 1990 to 2019, all except one county, which is Claiborne County up north, have seen warming over the summer months. And across all counties, the mean warming is like a quarter of a degree per decade with a max of 0.43 of a degree. The recent fourth National Climate Assessment that was completed in 2018 predicts that the annual mean temperature over the Southeast to increase by up to 1.9 to 2.4 degrees Celsius by mid-century. And as what Kelsey mentioned earlier, this assessment also predicts more frequent and more severe extreme precipitation events along with drier summers. So in riverine systems, in stream systems that I study, these long-term changes in air temperature and precipitation along with other human activities, such as land use change, they affect stream temperature and flow. And in the Southeast, a research collaborator of mine, Jacob LaFontaine of the USGS, used hydrologic models and found that, and he projected that flow reductions are likely to happen across all months, and there's greater summer flow variability. So some summers would be really dry, whereas others would be really wet. And all these impacts, right, would have would be able to affect biodiversity quite seriously.
And Isabella, you're the youngest guest I've had on the show, so I'm very excited for you to be here for this episode because so much climate action about some of these issues that Singley and Kelsey are talking about is coming from young people. So as we're hearing about some of these impacts, what made you want to be involved in climate advocacy?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it is these varied tornadoes and floods and wildfires in East Tennessee that I kind of witnessed growing up that made me want to sort of organize around not just climate change, but climate justice. I've lived in Tennessee my whole life. I'm from Nashville, Tennessee, and I remember in 2010 when massive floods just a half a mile away from my home were wiping homes from their foundations and flooding out businesses across Nashville. And then a few years later, we had the wildfires in Gatlinburg, where a lot of my friends lived near, which took lives, took extremely large amounts of infrastructure, buildings, and really decimated that area. So I think, you know, I have the privilege of having, you know, clean air, clean water. I don't have, you know, I'm not really closely living near like polluted drinking water like some populations, but at the same time, I have witnessed natural disasters in my own state, in my own home. And I think just kind of growing up with the constant sort of news cycles about climate change and how it's getting worse and worse, definitely sort of added to this idea that, you know, this is something that needs to be, that action needs to be taken now. And I think just witnessing these natural disasters that we're talking about kind of was a huge fuel for and drive for what I do now.
Kelsey, and you touched on this earlier, but I want to circle back to this question, one I think about a lot when I'm giving morning weather forecast. To what extent is extreme weather just part of living in Tennessee? And to what extent are humans contributing to it and making it worse moving forward?
Yeah, it's definitely a part of our climate here. We are always going to have heat waves. We're always going to have severe winter weather. We're always going to have tornadoes. But it's definitely being affected by global and local decisions. So globally, of course, we have greenhouse gas emissions and their impact on weather and climate. And that's a big problem. And like you said, maybe that's not tangible. And it sometimes makes us feel helpless, like what can we do about it? But locally, we are also affecting extreme weather and we can do things to mitigate its impacts. For example, if you consider heat waves, my colleagues and I put out temperature sensors in different neighborhoods in Knoxville and found out that poorer neighborhoods had fewer trees and were actually hotter. And these are also the neighborhoods where people are more vulnerable. So things like land use decisions, like trees in one place, can actually reduce some of the impacts locally and help more of our more vulnerable people. Another example of how humans are contributing locally with land decisions is their impact on flooding. So as we take away natural services and replace them with impervious services, then we're causing more flooding and we're controlling how much flooding is happening and when. So extreme weather will always happen, but we have the ability to keep it from becoming a disaster based on our decisions.
And Singley, much of your research focuses specifically on fish and aquatic life. What impacts has climate change had on aquatic communities in southern Appalachia? And how could those changes eventually impact humans?
That's a great question. So actually my students, collaborators and I are in the process of studying this to get a more complete understanding of human change, of climate change impacts on aquatic communities. To be honest, not a lot has been done in East Tennessee up to now or in Appalachia up to now, but we can get some ideas from research in other places. For instance, previous research in France has shown that riverine fish has moved upstream to a higher elevation areas in response to climate change. And the reason for this is that as a given reach of a river warms up, fish that have evolved to live in the historical thermal conditions of that river would now need to move upstream toward cooler habitat that matches their thermal preference. So the Appalachians actually span from lowlands to mountaintops. So there are cooler habitats for fish to move into, which is good compared to the coastal plains where, you know, minimal changes in elevation over a really long distance means that fish would have to swim a long way to reach cooler habitat. But a recent study that our group conducted actually found that after we account for the ability of the fish to disperse, we find that smaller tributary streams at high elevation, they do provide suitable thermal habitat for fish. But the problem is, while these habitats might be thermally suitable because they're cooler, they may not be physically suitable for the fish. Meaning, for instance, if fishes that are more adapted to the larger sandy rivers, they may not do so well in the smaller bouldery streams, even if it's cooler. And a lot of us, you know, we like to fish, we like to snorkel, swim, and generally recreate, you know, hike and enjoy the natural heritage of our streams and rivers in this really beautiful region. One problem of climate change is that we might see fewer fish in the habitats that we might be visiting with our family and friends, because these fish might have moved upstream, or they might not be able to tolerate the warmer waters due to climate change. So our future generations may actually have a different sense of place as we have had in the past.
And you're listening to Dialogue, How Climate Change Impacts East Tennessee. We'll talk about a few more specific regions in the South where climate change has been particularly significant after this break.
Support for WUOT comes from Sail Nashville, offering American Sailing Association instruction for the individual or the entire family on Percy Priest Lake near Nashville. Courses from dinghies to basic keelboat or bareboat chartering. More at sailnashville.com.
And you're listening to Dialogue, How Climate Change Impacts East Tennessee. And if you're listening in and would like to be part of the discussion, you can email us your questions at wuotnews@utk.edu. Or comment on our latest Dialogue post on Facebook or Twitter at WUOTFM, or you can call us at 865-974-5050. And I'm Claire Heddles. I'm joined virtually by Dr. Sing-Lee Guam, a conservation ecology expert, Isabel Achilles, the local coordinator for Sunrise Movement in Knoxville, and Dr. Kelsey Ellis, a geographer specializing in extreme weather. So, Isabella, I want to jump over to another part of Tennessee. One local campaign Sunrise Knoxville has been focused on is the Byhalia Pipeline in Memphis. So can you tell us, what is this pipeline and why do you think people should care about it?
Absolutely. So I think in the dialogue on climate change, it's really important to sort of recognize that the injustices associated with climate change and global warming are unevenly distributed, specifically along race and class lines. And with the Byhalia Pipeline in Memphis, we're really seeing this. To kind of give context on what has happened so far in Memphis, two companies called Plains All American Pipeline and Valero Energy Corporation were at one point, just a few weeks ago, attempting to build a pipeline through Southwest Memphis neighborhoods to transport crude oil for export. And the pipeline route would have gone through predominantly Black communities and communities of color in Memphis. And one specific community is called Boxtown, which was named after formerly enslaved people that use scraps of wood and metal and other materials from train boxcars to build their homes. Since then, the Shelby County Commission has put a stop to the sale of this property needed to move forward with the pipeline project. So currently there aren't solid plans to construct the pipeline in these communities. But the companies are looking at rerouting, and the fight definitely isn't over. The biggest group that has been sort of spearheading the fight against the pipeline in Memphis is called the Memphis Community Against the Pipeline, which has garnered a lot of attention. Al Gore actually came to speak at a rally in Memphis a few weeks ago, which also drew a lot of attention to this environmental injustice issue. But I think the biggest takeaway from the pipeline in Memphis is that it's such a blatant environmental injustice. And time again, pipelines, highways, and other fossil plants and, you know, waste plants have been located in Black communities and communities of color as a result of power relations. And I think when thinking about climate change, right, the energy that we're deriving from different sources, whether that be oil from pipelines or other sources, has really close interrelations with things like race and racial injustice. And so while the Byhalia pipeline is not currently being constructed in Memphis, there is always that threat. And I think it's extremely important to recognize that communities are still standing up to this threat now and will continue to say no to pipelines and sort of, stand up to this injustice.
And moving to East Tennessee for just a moment, Kelsey, in one study you've done, you found people living in East Tennessee were less likely to receive a nighttime tornado warning. I'm wondering if you can tell us more about those findings and their significance.
Yeah, so research has clearly shown that tornadoes that happen at night are more fatal. That's for several reasons. One obvious one being that it's hard to tell people a tornado is headed their way if they're asleep. We surveyed Tennessee residents, 1,800 of them, and 50% say they don't think they would get a tornado warning if it happened at night. So half of people don't think they're getting the alert. And East Tennesseans were more likely to say that. And it seems to be related to the fact that in East Tennessee, we have fewer tornadoes than the rest of the state. So people haven't been affected by one, and they don't think they will happen here. And so they don't go out of their way to get a warning. So the Weather Service, National Weather Service, always says you should have multiple ways to get a warning at night, not including sirens. Those are not made to wake people up at night. Those are just made to alert people that are outside. And in East Tennessee, people don't really feel the need, though. They don't feel the need to buy a weather radio. And so when the warnings happen at night, they may not have ways to get those alerts.
And Singley, I'll turn back to you for a moment. Beyond the immediate human question that we're talking about, how is climate change also impacting the risk of species extinction in Tennessee? What species are most at risk?
So when we want to quantify climate change impacts on species, we need to know, firstly, which species are most exposed to climate change based on where they occur. And secondly, which species are sensitive to the changes that actually occur. So my collaborators and I, quick shout out to Paul Armsworth and Mona Papesh in my department, the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at UTK, we use statistical models to estimate where species of conservation concern occur in the Appalachians based on current climates. And then by combining these models with future climate projections, we can then see for each species where their suitable habitats are currently versus where their habitats will shift to in the future. And so assuming a conservative scenario where species can't really move from their current locations, which is a reasonable scenario in many areas in our region and in Tennessee, because the intact natural forest habitat is often so fragmented by a network of urban and ex-urban areas, suburban sprawl, roads, and even agricultural landscapes that like patches of forest are actually pretty far apart. So assuming this scenario where species can't move from forest to forest, about a third of forest-dependent land vertebrate species, so we're talking about birds, amphibians, mammals, and reptiles, so about a third of them are predicted to lose half or more of its current habitat area by the 2080s. And in general, amphibians and mammals are predicted to lose more habitat than birds and reptiles. But if we assume optimistically that species can actually move to new habitats, range size declines are reduced for some species, and some birds and reptiles may even see some range size increases. However, given what we know about the distances that species can actually move, birds are really the only group that can potentially disperse long distances to reach new habitat. But even then, many birds that are forest dependent, means birds that depend on forests for their survival, they probably wouldn't like flying over large swaths of urban or agricultural land, and they may not reach these new climatically unsuitable habitats. And so back to the question, of like what group is most at risk, I would say, amphibians and in particular salamanders, they're probably the group that's going to be most at risk owing to their really highly restricted distributions to start with, and the fact that they do not move very far and certainly not across forest patches. So as climate warms, they may be forced to move up mountains to reach cooler and more suitable habitats. But as warming proceeds, you know, because they're moving up mountains, right, they may really run out of space or room to move.
And as we think about species at risk, humans at risk, we got a question from Facebook that I'll pose now. Maybe Kelsey could answer this. Kristen on Facebook asked us, it seems clear that climate change is occurring. Can you please share evidence specifically showing causation of climate shifts by human action versus naturally occurring change? So we touched on that a little bit earlier, but Kelsey, would you like to address this question we received on Facebook?
Yeah, so what we're looking for evidence of climate change, we don't necessarily connect, say, an increased intensity of hurricanes directly to like carbon dioxide emissions. Instead, we just look at to see if as carbon dioxide emissions have come up during recent time periods, if something has changed. And so we take a long period of time, hopefully like 50, 60 or 100 years worth of data, and we try to regress out all of the natural variability that we know to the impacts like El Nino and other lesser known climate oscillations. And then we see what trend is left behind. And then it's often that we see like maybe an increase in a trend, and then we say, well, is this just because of the data? For example, tornado data are very biased to where people live because you have to see a tornado to report it. And they're also biased through time because we're seeing more now. And so then you have to deal with those data problems. And at the end, what you're looking for is a trend that's showing that something has changed. And I think that this area is so heavily studied right now that you can feel confident that a lot of the literature out there that's saying these things are happening due to climate change has been really well vetted. And that includes those findings on tornadoes that I mentioned, the precipitation changes that a couple of us have mentioned on here. So really we're just looking for those trends over time that can, after removing all of the other cycles that we know.
And in thinking specifically about Tennessee, Isabella, I'll turn back to you for a moment. In your communication with young people in other parts of the country that are involved in Sunrise Movement, have you noticed anything unique or different about organizing for climate justice in East Tennessee?
Definitely. I think no matter where you organize around climate change, everybody recognizes we need to take action, but the ways in which we take action against climate change definitely vary regionally and culturally. Kind of looking at the work that Sunrise organizers are doing in the other parts of the country, a lot of it is defined by the political environment in which they're organizing. And here in Tennessee, in East Tennessee, we are quite red politically. We have a supermajority, Republican majority, I should say, in the Tennessee State Legislature. So when it comes to kind of fighting for climate policy, both on local and state levels, I think the organizing that we do has to shift accordingly to who we're targeting. So instead of directly targeting politicians saying, hey, this is what we want from you as far as climate action, it's about absorbing people on the ground, whether that be just community members, residents, other organizers, and kind of building a force to be reckoned with on the ground. On things like the Green New Deal and other forms of climate action. I think also it's how you frame the climate crisis that matters here in East Tennessee, focusing on local issues. One big facet of Sunrise's kind of work and approach is the idea of jobs as inextricably related to climate change, right? We know that in the transition away from the fossil fuel economy, we will have to create clean, safe jobs. And sort of focus on who's losing their job from fossil fuel industries and who can gain a job in a renewable energy system. And that should be everyone who can gain a job. So kind of in East Tennessee, where the Tennessee Valley Authority is headquartered and where coal has had a really long legacy, it's about focusing on making sure people can live, work, and kind of just have a decent quality of life. So while it's important to focus on the politics of the climate crisis, I think it's also important to focus on the job aspect of the climate crisis here in East Tennessee, kind of saying that we're not going to leave anyone kind of behind in this fight for climate action. Everyone deserves jobs and everyone deserves to maintain their quality of life. I think it's also important, one last thing, to recognize there is a really deep history of organizing here in East Tennessee. Specifically against industries like coal, the Battle of Blair Mountain, which has occurred in the early 1900s, was the largest labor uprising in United States history. And so I think tying in our current fights for labor and climate justice, we need to recognize past fights for labor and environmental justice.
And you're listening right now to Dialogue, How Climate Change Impacts East Tennessee. I'm Claire Heddles, and I'm joined virtually by Dr. Kelsey Ellis, a geographer specializing in extreme weather, Dr. Singli Guillaume, a conservation ecology expert, and you just heard from Isabella Kilius, who's the local coordinator for Sunrise Movement in Knoxville. And as we talk about preparing for the future with climate change in mind, Singli, you've studied a bit the relationship between climate change and future demand for food. I'm wondering if you can talk more about that relationship, how climate change impacts the future human demand for food and resources.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So as the human population increases throughout the world, the future demand for food is bound to increase, right? But there are particular types of food that may exert disproportionately larger impacts on climate change and biodiversity. For example, palm oil, which is used in many food products, including candy like Kit Kat and Snickers to cookies and potato chips, stuff that we all like, or at least stuff that I like. Palm oil was a major driver of deforestation in Southeast Asia from the 90s to the present. So forests are logged and they're burned to clear the land needed to plant the crop. The removal of forests also mean that they can no longer remove carbon from the air, and the burning of vegetation directly adds carbon into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. To make things worse, much of the land used to plant oil palm are on flooded peatlands that store a large amount of carbon in peat. And when peatlands are cleared and drained for oil palm, the dry peat breaks down and releases more carbon dioxide into the air. And other foods also have a really high carbon footprint as well. For instance, shrimp, like particularly those harvested from shrimp farms that were converted from tropical mangroves, and beef from cattle that's raised on pastures that were converted from tropical rainforests. A recent study that was published in the Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment by Dr. Boone Kaufman and his colleagues from Oregon State University found that, you know, by consuming a surf and turf entree dinner, which consists of 16 ounces of steak and 4 ounces of shrimp, we are releasing up to 816 kilograms of carbon dioxide equivalent into the atmosphere, which is the same amount of carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere by driving a gas vehicle from LA to New York City. So I know that this, you know, is a really high number, and I actually went and dug up the numbers and I checked previous studies, and other studies actually gave lower numbers, but they did because they did not or they incompletely accounted for land use change impacts, which means the amount of carbon that goes in the air because forests are being cut down. So some of these studies actually gave the impact as 28 kilograms of carbon dioxide equivalent per surf and turf dinner. That is still equivalent to about 3 gallons of fuel that will be used by a Ford Focus traveling from Knoxville to Asheville. And lastly, I just want to say that, you know, climate change can also have an impact on food production. So we talked about how humans can demand for food can impact climate change, but climate change can turn back and impact food production as well. Research by my colleagues at UTK, Luis Carrasco, Mona Papesh, and Greg Wiggins actually projected climate change to result in declines in wild pollinators in the US, which would then affect tomato production in the country. So yeah, so our demand for food drives climate change, and climate change would also have a profound impact on food sources as well.
And Kelsey, you've researched the relationship between climate and suicide, comparing cities in Canada to Jackson, Mississippi. What are the most significance of that research? And is there anything different about trends in the United States compared to Toronto, Canada?
We've actually, we've done a few papers on this and found that the patterns we see in the Southeast U.S. really match the patterns kind of across North America in general. And that's, you know, most research shows there's a cyclical trend throughout the year on suicide rates. And it's always been attributed to climate just because it's easy to show that relationship. But we're now starting to think that that's correlation and not causation. And perhaps there's some things that happen on the calendar year that actually cause that cyclical rate instead of the climate changing throughout the year. But we have seen the impacts of extremely warm weeks, for example, causing an increase in suicide rates. So abnormal weather is perhaps affecting suicide rates in all the areas that we studied. So kind of North America, like I said, but climate itself or the change of weather throughout the year itself isn't seen as a cause.
And you're listening to Dialogue, How Climate Change Impacts East Tennessee. We'll look at what's being done to mitigate the impacts in this region after the break.
Support for WUOT comes from LMU DeBusk College of Osteopathic Medicine, hosting the annual Essentials of Clinical Medicine Conference in June with keynote speaker Dr. Patch Adams. Registration at dcomalumni.lmunet.edu.
And this is Dialogue, How Climate Change Impacts East Tennessee. And if you're listening right now and would like to be a part of our discussion, you can email us your questions at wuotnews@utk.edu or comment on our latest Dialogue post on Twitter or Facebook. We're at WUOTFM. Or you can call us. That number is 865-974-5050. Again, that number is 875-974-5050. And I'm Claire Heddles. I'm joined virtually by Dr. Singli Guam, a conservation ecology expert, Isabella Killius, the local coordinator for Sunrise Movement in Knoxville, and Dr. Kelsey Ellis, a geographer specializing in extreme weather. More information about our guests is on our website, wuot.org. And Isabella, your organization collaborates with a lot of progressive groups in Knoxville. How do you see climate action intersecting with the fight for racial justice and other local movements here?
The fight for climate action and climate justice intersects with racial justice, with healthcare justice, with gender justice, with reproductive justice. The list goes on and on. I think historically there's been a lot of issues with the progressive movement, especially progressive climate movements. In that the work that different movements and groups do are siloed and not really recognizing their connections with other justice issues. So I think grassroots means listening to other groups on the ground, sort of working directly with other groups and recognizing the necessity and sort of interconnections of one form of work with another form of work. Sunrise focuses, and sort of its main tenet is the Green New Deal. For those of you who don't know what the Green New Deal is or don't know a lot about it, it's sort of this sweeping bundle of legislation or potential legislation that was introduced to the House floor in early 2019 by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey, essentially attempting to address the need for a transition away from the fossil fuel economy in an equitable way. And translating that onto more of a grassroots sort of on the ground level, things like environmental injustice, whether that be pollution or fixing infrastructure after natural disasters, disproportionately falls on certain populations. And so racial justice groups that are attempting to mitigate these injustices in Knoxville, even, who are representative of racial groups that have been historically marginalized, are critical in the fight against climate change. I think it's important to think about who climate change will affect the most. We know we're all going to be sort of affected or sort of live within climate change, but as far as who's living on the front lines of these toxic waste sites or who doesn't have access to renewable or reliable energy, all of these battles intersect with each other, and it's important to uplift the work of racial justice organizers and groups because these historically, once again, are the groups that have not been represented in this fight and who have not had decision-making capacities in this fight against climate change. So I think we hear this a lot, like climate justice is racial justice. I think especially this summer in the wake of the George Floyd protests, we saw these sort of buzzwords a lot, but it is true, and it's important to kind of see this as all one big collective form of unity, right? Moving forward against climate change as opposed to fighting for racial justice, then fighting for climate justice. It's all sort of related. So,
and Singli, part of your research has been into how messaging about conservation impacts people's attitudes towards sustainability. What sort of messages about climate change have you found in your research to be the most compelling?
Yeah, great question. So in the study that I did when I was a PhD student, we found that just by making consumers be aware of the environmental impacts of buying a given product. So in my study, we studied palm oil as an ingredient. So the consumers expressed that they were less likely to buy a product containing palm oil and or containing palm oil that came from deforestation and stated that they were more willing to pay about 8 to 10% more for the sustainably sourced version of that product. So regarding attitudes towards climate change, I have not studied this myself, but I read from a recent Pew survey conducted in 2019 that more Americans support prioritizing policies that protect the environment and policies that mitigate climate change than compared to 10 years ago. And more than two-thirds of the respondents in that survey also say that the federal government is not doing enough to mitigate climate change. Well, I think this is pretty consistent with what I found from my palm oil study, that humans don't like to be knowingly contributing to environmental damage, and that we care about the environment, or at least that's what we say, right? So perhaps if we educate people behind the science and evidence of what's happening, we can get more people on board. But interestingly, the same Pew Trust survey also showed that high scientific literacy was correlated with knowledge about climate change among Democrats, but not Republicans. So I think this is a really complicated issue, and it might be driven by differences in political beliefs. You know, but at the same time, a 2015 nationwide survey of 1,000 registered voters who hunt or fish found that about 83% of these respondents supported applying rules of the Clean Water Act to smaller headwater streams and wetlands. And there was bipartisan support ranging from 77% of registered Republican voters, 79% of independents, and 97% of Democrats. And it's also worth noting that that particular sample had more registered Republicans than Democrats. So it really showed that, you know, environmental protections, it's a bipartisan issue. So I know the fishing example or hunting example doesn't relate to climate change, but it speaks to the importance of experience in shaping our attitudes. Like how hunters and anglers that have developed experiences that produce a connection to and understanding of the environment, I think multiple studies have shown associations that range from weak to moderate associations between experiencing extreme weather events and changes in local weather conditions over a period of time to their belief in climate change. Though one of these studies also showed that, value systems and political beliefs still exert a greater effect on belief in climate change over kind of experience. So, yeah, I mean, there's no easy answer to that question.
Definitely. And Kelsey, you also look at how humans impact their climate, but also how humans are impacted by their climate. Can you share some insights into some ways climate influences human behavior?
This topic, my students love this topic, and they always end the semester of my climatology class saying, weather and climate control everything, because they always pick for their topics ways that climate affects climb rates or where people are traveling or their daily activities. And there's plenty of literature out there showing that it affects everything. And one project I did with a PhD student, we put something called an eye button on Knoxville residents, and it's about the size of a nickel. And what it does is it records their temperature, really their heat index exposure throughout the day. And we had them wear it for 2 weeks over the summer during a heat wave and a non-heat wave. And we found that just being told that they were in a heat wave made them do things that kind of reduce their exposure to heat. And so they would turn on their air conditioning or not go for a walk outside and really just change what they did throughout the day. But then during a non-heat wave, they didn't do any of those things. And the conclusion was that they were more exposed to extreme heat during a non-heat wave because they weren't like changing their activities. So not only does climate affect what they're doing, but also media messaging about the weather and climate is also affecting their daily activities.
And in thinking specifically about Knoxville, Isabella, Sunrise Knoxville is part of Mayor India Kincannon's Climate Council, and you helped organize a climate emergency march in Knoxville. From your vantage point as a student and organizer, in what ways have you seen local leaders address climate change, and what else do you think is needed?
That's a question that I could talk for a long time about as far as what are local leaders doing around kind of the climate crisis and around climate injustice in Knoxville. Sunrise has organized a few different actions, including a climate emergency march, asking former Mayor Madeline Rojero to declare a climate emergency, which is essentially a resolution that a city or municipality passes to act on climate change within a certain time frame. There are a lot of groups that Sunrise Knoxville partners with and collaborates with in the Knoxville landscape on climate action. One that I'll highlight is called the Tennessee Valley Energy Democracy Movement. That's working to essentially democratize the Tennessee Valley Authority and make energy more accessible, affordable, and such that the public has a say in their energy decision making. And the Tennessee Valley Energy Democracy Movement is a coalition of different progressive groups, and Knoxville Sunrise is part of this movement that has put on several actions focusing on worker protection, especially coal ash worker protection in the wake of things like the Kingston Coal Ash Spill, which has taken the lives of over 50 Kingston Coal Ash workers, and workers are still ill. So once again, this is not only the fight for energy justice and climate justice, but labor justice. Another group that I'll also highlight that Sunrise and I have worked with is a group near the TVA fossil plant Bull Run, which is located in Claxton, Tennessee. It's called the Bull Run's Neighbors Group, and they've done a lot of work around standing up to TVA, which is essentially closing this fossil plant. And a huge question kind of lingers in regard to where all of the coal ash stored in this plant, where all of this coal ash is going to go. And so these neighbors, these community organizers and leaders have really shaped the narrative around coal ash in Knoxville, around coal ash injustices. And so I definitely want to highlight their work. And as far as things like weatherization and renewable energy in Knoxville, SEED, which stands for Socially Equal Energy Efficient Development, is an amazing organization in Knoxville that focuses on weatherization of homes and making homes more renewably sourced and outfitted such that they are receiving their energy from cleaner and more affordable sources. So once again, I could go on and on about leaders in Knoxville that I've seen address climate change, but a common trend that I see with these leaders is that they're representative of the communities they're fighting for, and they're tireless in their work. So I think once again, emphasizing climate change and addressing climate change is an intersectional fight, and all of these different groups are coming at the climate crisis from different angles, whether that be energy, whether that be specific ideas around energy like coal ash, but all of these leaders are tireless in their work.
And Singley, from your background in studying biodiversity and aquatic life, what sort of actions and mitigation strategies do you think are needed to protect biodiversity in Tennessee?
Yeah, so I think, you know, looking at mitigating climate change impacts on biodiversity, I think the Biden 30 by 30 initiative is a really great policy that aims to protect 30% of U.S. lands and oceans by 2030. That's why it's called 30 by 30. You want to protect 30% of the lands and oceans by 2030, because currently only 12% of lands in the U.S. are protected. Where these new lands should be protected is an important question. So ideally, it should be protected not just where the imperiled or rare species are at. The areas that are most vulnerable to habitat conversion should be protected as well. If not, then we are just extending protections to places that aren't at risk from human activities, right? So for example, most protected lands globally, they skew towards high and far areas. So areas at really high elevation and far away from human population centers that are at little risk from being converted or affected by human activity. Precisely because it's cheaper to protect those lands and it's not under developmental pressure. And also I think the current administration's push to encourage electric vehicle use and ownership by improving the infrastructure for EVs, electric vehicles, can hopefully help to reduce carbon emissions and, you know, therefore reduce climate change impacts on biodiversity. So moving down more locally and regionally, I think state resources agencies like TWRA, regional agencies like TVA and NGOs, they're all playing really important and complementary roles in protecting biodiversity. From my interactions and meetings and collaborations with them, I know that all these stakeholders are really interested and invested in understanding which biodiversity are most vulnerable to climate change and where conservation efforts need to be concentrated. And every 10 years, each state resource agency actually comes up with a state wildlife action plan. And the next one is due in 2025. So I'm really excited to work with the agencies on that. And then moving down even more on a personal level, we can make decisions like, you know, like eating less high carbon footprint foods. Like perhaps start by planning some days of the week where we increase the fraction of plants in our meals, or consider getting a hybrid or electric vehicle, or even just a more energy efficient fuel vehicle, or buying used stuff whenever possible, writing to your government representatives like your council members and your congresspersons. And of course, you can join grassroots movements like Isabella's Sunrise Movement as well. So these are the things that you could personally contribute to.
And you're listening to Dialogue, How Climate Change Impacts East Tennessee. That was Dr. Singley Guillaume, a conservation ecology expert. We're also joined by Isabella Killias, the local coordinator for Sunrise Movement in Knoxville, and Dr. Kelsey Ellis, a geographer specializing in extreme weather. And Kelsey, based on your field of expertise, what do you think are the most concerning effects of climate change in Tennessee, both in the present and in the future?
Because of my focus on extreme weather, obviously that's where my concerns are. And really, my biggest concern is just about the overall increased hazard risk to vulnerable populations. With my heat work, even specifically in Knoxville, we show that the poorer neighborhoods in Knoxville are experiencing more extreme heat, and we're expecting increased intensity and frequency and duration of heat waves. And so to have it a few degrees warmer in those neighborhoods, perhaps in places where people can't afford air conditioning, is going to be a problem. With my tornado work, we worry about unsafe homes. People living in mobile or manufactured homes are at a much greater risk to being hurt or even killed by a tornado. And they also may live in rural areas. A lot of mobile homes in the Southeast are in rural areas where people have bad cell phone signals, and so they're not getting warnings. And so really, I am concerned about how the increase in these extreme weather hazards is going to be seen mostly in our vulnerable populations.
And Isabella, your organization is actually holding a rally tonight focused on jobs that address climate change. What would you like to see from local industries like TVA?
TVA is the largest federal public power provider in the nation, and it's headquartered here in Knoxville. And I think tying into the idea of good jobs in the transition away from reliance on fossil fuels, TVA can be a huge leader in providing good, clean, safe union jobs to people who have been employed by the fossil fuel industry historically. So just to kind of shamelessly plug our action tonight, it's going to be at 5 p.m. at 800 Market Street in front of the courthouse, and we're going to kind of rally around climate action and good jobs. Marquita Bradshaw, who ran for U.S. Senate for the state of Tennessee and was actually the first African-American woman to run for any major political position in Tennessee, will be speaking at our rally, so we're really excited about that. But kind of tying into, again, the idea of good jobs and the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority operates essentially as a federal corporation. So its board members are nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate, as its CEO, who is currently Jeff Lyash. And kind of an idea that has really come up within the past few years around the TVA, once again, the Tennessee Valley Energy Democracy Movement is doing work around this, is to democratize the TVA, meaning that board members and the CEO are elected by the public. There are multiple protections among workers that make sure during disasters like coal ash spills or other chemical spills, workers are adequately protected from these chemicals. It means open board meetings so people can have a say in their energy decision making. TVA currently does not operate, or largely does not operate on open board meetings. It's very hard to have a say in someone's energy decisions or bills. It also means changing things like how people are billed for energy, like rather than a flat rate, a percentage of income according to how much someone can afford. So we want to see from TVA a more justice-oriented approach. And we also really in general just want to see TVA take a very strong forward direction when it comes to transitioning away from dependency on fossil fuels, specifically coal and natural gas, and really be a leader in the energy industry on things like wind and solar. Because we know that we're kind of on a ticking time bomb right now when it comes to the climate crisis. We're working with decades, not centuries, and we want TVA to be a leader in transitioning away from the fossil fuel economy while making sure people are equipped with good jobs in the process.
Well, thank you so much. That was Isabella Killius, the local coordinator for Sunrise Movement in Oxville. You've also been hearing from Dr. Singli Gyum, a conservation ecology expert, and Dr. Kelsey Ellis, a geographer specializing in extreme weather. You've been listening to Dialogue, How Climate Change Impacts East Tennessee. I'm your host, Claire Huddles, and I want to extend a special thank you to Greg Hill for his assistance in producing this show. This is WUOT News on 91.9 FM, WUOT.